The information in this podcast is provided for education and research information only. It is not a substitute for professional health advice.
If you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, and you feel a little bit overwhelmed by all you need to know, then this is the right podcast for you. Welcome to the show. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney, and this is The Kick, your expert-led podcast that delivers the essentials of growing a baby. Make sure you head to our website, growmybaby.com.au, to get some awesome free tools like our Pregnancy Knowledge Checker to help you feel like you got this.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm Bridget Maloney and I'm flying solo today without our co-host, Dr. Pat. Dr. Pat is busy in theatre, which has given me this great opportunity to sit opposite the lovely Dr. Kylie McKenzie. Now, Kylie is a clinical psychologist and experienced supervisor with over 20 years' experience. She has presented nationally and internationally about her research into models of care and communication when working with people living with both mental and physical conditions. Kylie is a senior clinical consultant with the University of Melbourne's Department of General Practice, providing advice about the development of behaviour change intervention. She also works as a clinical psychologist at our Ballarat Women's Clinic, working with women thinking about starting a family or who are currently pregnant or they've just become a new mum. Welcome, Kylie.
Thanks, Bridget. It's lovely to be here.
It really is. It's great to have you. And Kylie and I have lots of corridor chats, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yep. About life in general, children, our practice, everything. It's just such a valuable thing to have you on board, Kylie. So thanks for coming today.
Well, it's coming up to my 1-year anniversary this week.
And I can't believe how fast that's gone.
It has flown and the work's been amazing. So as you say, it's this privilege to be able to work with people as they transition all the way through pregnancy and parenting journey, and just for some people, that addition of talking to a professional like a psychologist can just take the edge off what can be a little bit stressful.
Yeah, and I would say it's just not a little bit stressful. It's a major life change for most of us, isn't it?
It really is, and I think it has. Has so much meaning involved in it. So for some people, it's the goal. It's the thing that they've wanted to do all their lives, and they've got so much invested in it. And I think as women as well, there's this pressure to do everything and do everything so well, and that can really impact on people's mood and also on anxiety. And I think that those two things are what you and I have talked about, that it would be helpful to have some ideas for people to, as they're preparing to be pregnant or if they're pregnant or if they've just had a baby, it's like, you know, what am I looking out for and what are the things that I've got some agency or some, you know, I can be in control of that will help me.
Mm. And in your 20 years of experience, do you think, like I'm hearing that word perfectionism, and do you think that that has changed at all in those 20 years? Do you think we're becoming more wanting to be that perfect parent?
Oh, I actually feel like it's actually always been there. I think we probably talk about it more, which is a really good thing. And the idea of having those expectations on ourselves and not wondering if we're going to meet them and then wondering if we're falling short of them, I think it's always been there. But, you know, in the last 20 years, one of the major things that's happened is that we talk about our mental health. We talk about the things that impact and the things that we could do that are more helpful. Mm. And I think, you know, being a mum of a nearly 21-year-old, I don't think those were the sorts of conversations that were had very often 20 years ago. I think it was more likely that you worked it out or you didn't work it out and you had a really tough time. And so now I think that we've got a little bit more of a window into really supporting people and acknowledging that it can be a really tough time.
Do you think it's a good place to start our conversation at talking about what is good mental health?
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about that particularly over the last year, but we've talked about it for a long time. And you can get kind of all tied up in what's not going well and the fear of what might not go well. And we sometimes forget to stop and say, well, actually, you know, how would I feel if my mental health was really robust? What would that mean for me? And I think it's a really good place to start.
Yeah, because robust mental health, it doesn't mean that we're always up, does it?
Absolutely not. And if you were always up, I think that would be a little bit concerning,
that's a bit manic
as well. That's right.
Yeah.
Most people have sort of highs and times when they are feeling really good or excited about something, but that doesn't last forever, and expecting it to is really unrealistic. So I think there's this idea of good mental health being the ability to experience a whole range of emotions, but still manage to feel like you can do the things that are important to you in your day, be that work or parenting or even some of the things that you might do in your community. So feeling like you've got this capacity to do and to engage in a range of things, I think that that's a real key to what good mental health is. But also recognising that everybody feels sad, everybody gets worried about some things, and it's that's okay as long as it doesn't tip into that being the thing that is the biggest feature of how you feel all day, every day.
Mm.
So it's recognising the whole scope. We have a whole scope of emotions that we feel, and that's okay. And in fact, that's kind of the human experience. And it's if some of those feelings that are maybe a little bit more difficult, you know, like grief or like anxiety or feeling a bit flat, it's where they last such a long time that they impact on our relationships and they impact on being able to do the stuff that you really value in your life.
Mm. And thinking about pregnancy or becoming a mum, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with postnatal depression,
mm-hmm.
but I just wondered if we could sort of talk about what are the common mental health illnesses that we talk about during this perinatal period.
Yeah, and I think, that's not that dissimilar to common mental health issues that you would feel that people experience in all times in their life, and the most common things are anxiety and depression. And maybe it's worth talking a little bit about what those things mean.
Yeah.
Because I know that in the work that I do that's sometimes people, like, they don't really
know how to name it.
No. I don't feel right. Everything's a bit foggy, or like I feel like I'm sort of really worked up all the time, like I can't settle down.
Mm.
So I think that there's all those things that can contribute to, feeling not right.
Mm.
And that's probably where it makes sense to have a talk about what those things are. And maybe...
You're listening to The Kick with Dr. Pat and Bridget.
Hi, everyone. Well, we've got a milestone coming up and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners. May 7th, we're going to launch our 100th episode of The Kick. And guess what? We couldn't have done it without our listeners. To celebrate, we are asking for you to tell us your biggest tips about getting pregnant, being pregnant, becoming a mother, birth, anything that you think future listeners might benefit from. And we want 100 voices. As a gift to you for adding your voice, we will give everyone a whopping 50% discount to any of our programs. You can use this yourself or gift it to a friend. To add your voice, go to our website, growmybaby.com.au. We will then put a selection of the voices together for our 100th episode. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So the website again is growmybaby.com.au. We are so excited to hear all your biggest tips for future mamas just like you.
Maybe starting with the idea that anxiety can be something that really features when people are first pregnant and throughout pregnancy, that's something that I think when I work with people, they're like, oh, that's the thing that's the problem for me.
So what's the most common sort of feeling or emotion that someone with anxiety would describe to you?
I think it's just a constant state of worry, that's what most people would describe. And maybe what's helpful is for you know, some people sort of understand that anxiety is this sort of worry. And when you're pregnant, the content of the worry changes. And so people worry about their health. They worry about their all these things that are happening in their body that are different. What does that mean? And is that okay? Mm. Is that a problem? Is that something that I should ask about? Is it something that is nothing? Is it minor? Is it massive? And they can get tied up in loops of that worry about health. So that's something that features. It's all the little changes become something to really put a magnifying glass to in such a way that it becomes really big and scary.
Can I talk about scale? Because I would imagine that, you know, you don't know what you don't know when you go into pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And you do worry about every little symptom. And, you know, you might turn to your friend Google and start searching and going down a bit of a rabbit hole. What's normal and when is that really what you would class as anxiety?
Oh, that's a really good question because I think we all go to Dr. Google a little bit. And I think I'm not even sure how to answer that because some people will go and they will say, you know, look at a piece of, you know, something that they're worried about and they'll get an answer and they'll be like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Mm. Some people will look at that answer and then they'll look at another answer and then they'll look at another answer and then they'll look at another answer. And I think when it becomes something that you can't let go, then it's a problem. I think that's kind of what you're asking. Yeah. When is it a problem? When I can't feel settled about it. Mm. And I think that probably there's a couple of things that are helpful to think about with that, and that is to stick to really reliable sources if you can.
Mm.
So to be, you know, things like Health Direct, to go to sources where you know that there's an evidence base for it. Because I know that I've had some people who go into chat rooms and then they hear everybody else's things that they're worried about and then they start wondering if those are things they should worry about themselves.
Mm.
So talking with your healthcare team, really, really important.
And one of those in our program, and hopefully people have got it through our podcast, is we talk about the forum, the chat rooms, where, you know, you're actually canvassing an opinion of people that might have a totally different experience than yours.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't see how that would be actually helping somebody's anxiety if that's what they've got.
Yeah. And like when you go and you see your obstetrician or your midwife, they know you. So they've got an understanding of you and what's changing for you, as well as all their knowledge about, you know, what happens generally in a pregnancy, as opposed to somebody that doesn't know you and is offering you advice without understanding what's real for you. So reliable information can be really helpful. I think to further answer your question, I think if people get information from a reliable source and that doesn't feel like it helps, that's probably a time where your anxiety is tipping into worry about worry. And that's what people will describe, is that, you know, well, I know that I don't need to worry about that thing anymore because my doctor or my midwife made that really clear. But now I'm worrying about something else, and then I'm worrying about something else, and then I'm still worrying about it even though I've got the reliable information. So if your worry meter is really, really high, maybe there are some other strategies that help with your worry.
Yeah. And we'll get to those at the end of our podcast. I really want to give people some practical tips. But what other sort of feelings or emotions do people describe to you when they're seeing you?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the anxiety side of things we've talked a bit about. And the other thing that people talk about is just feeling really flat. That kind of just not having the enthusiasm for the things that they thought they would have. And that can be an indicator of your mood not being quite right. So that's what depression is. Depression is when you don't have the interest or enjoyment in your daily life, in the things that you're engaged in. You don't feel like you've got the ability to enjoy things. And so people describe that as just feeling like really flat, really like I've just got nothing in me. Or they describe this kind of fog, and that's probably more, you know, something people have described post-pregnancy. And you can sort of see where that comes from, that you've got this big change, your body's been through a really big experience, your sleep is not the same as it was, and you're now responsible for another person, like this little human that you've got. And so there's a really big demand as well. So people describe this kind of, I feel like I'm in a fog. And pulling that apart's really important, because sometimes it is, you know, lack of sleep. Sometimes it is some self-care and some good food and a little bit of more rest that can make the difference. But sometimes it is that my mood's actually tipped into being just being flat and ongoing, and it's persisting, and doing sensible things isn't helping, and I might need a little bit more assistance with that.
So most of our listeners would have heard of the term baby blues.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just describe that and how that differs from postnatal depression?
The key difference is that baby blues doesn't keep going. So lots of women do experience that, and it's the 3 to 10 days after the baby's born, and it can feel, and it is impacted by sleep, but it can feel like just feeling really teary or sort of weepy over things that wouldn't maybe normally be something that you would cry about, feeling irritable or like your mood's a bit flat, and sometimes people will describe feeling a little bit detached from the baby and from others around them. The difference with postpartum depression is that this is, baby blues is short term. It's something that, you know, impacts physically, and it goes away. Postnatal depression is some of those similar feelings of feeling like, you know, you feel very sad, like you don't feel like you've got that joy in life, and you're not enjoying things the way you thought you would. And when you look to the future, you're feeling pessimistic about it. And it can be associated with things like not sleeping well, like having, you know, difficulties with concentration, feeling very sensitive to other people's comments. But really the big difference is that it persists, and it's persisted for 2 weeks or more, and it's really impacting on your ability to do the things that are important to you.
So I know that that in Australia, and I'm not sure about other countries, you might know, but in Australia everyone is screened for postpartum depression. Can you describe what that is and when that happens?
Well, I can describe some parts of that. So in Australia, it's routine screening, and it's done by a range of health professionals. So, you know, in state Victoria where we are, maternal child health nurses will do that. Mostly in Australia, we use something called the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Screening Tool. And it's a pretty simple series of questions that women ask about how things have affected them during the past week, and it's been shown to give us an indicator of whether postnatal depression or significant anxiety are likely. So there's been some population studies that help us to understand that if you score more than this on this measure, then it's likely that you might have a mood disorder or serious or significant anxiety. So that happens with contact with health professionals in Australia, so maternal child health nurses, midwives, obstetricians and gynaecologists sometimes use that as well, and certainly psychologists. It's a recommended measure too for women in that women who are pregnant and in the up to, you know, a year past the baby being born. So it's just a way of checking in and making sure we've got a measure. Particularly, I think it's helpful when sometimes people find it hard to talk about how they're feeling. So it can be helpful to support that if someone knows something's not quite right, but they maybe haven't got the words or it's a new experience for them. The UK and the US, they screen for postnatal depression as well. And the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale is a UK measure originally, I think. So. Yeah. That's part of what gets used there as well.
I know in the Edinburgh scoring, it asks you questions that feel really direct. From memory, one of them is something like, you know, do you have thoughts of harming yourself or the baby?
Yep.
And that is a really direct question that I'm imagining. Oh, I found it direct. I don't know, you know, whether others do, but why do they ask that question?
They ask that question because it's a really key indicator of how somebody is feeling. If you are feeling like there is no joy in the world, or you're feeling like really quite hopeless and like the future isn't offering something that you'd hoped for, then that feeling that hurting yourself, suicide, or hurting the baby might be something that occurs to you. And it's a very serious symptom of depression or of postnatal psychosis. So not everybody will feel that, and that's it's really important to know that something like postnatal psychosis, where people are experiencing highly irrational thoughts and feelings, potentially having hallucinations, so seeing things or hearing things that aren't really there, that's actually really rare. It's really serious and it can be treated. But if you're having those thoughts, and if you're having experiences where reality doesn't feel quite right to you, that's a really strong sign of needing to seek some help. Mm. So it's asked really directly because you don't want it to be something that people don't understand what you're asking, and because it's such an important thing. And I guess I would say to anybody who's listening, if you have those kinds of thoughts, that's a real indicator of seeking help. Mm. It's not an indicator that you have done something wrong, that you are a bad person or a bad mum. It's an indicator that you need some help, and that your mood and what's happening for you is causing you to think thoughts that are serious and distressing.
Mm.
And we can help with that.
I know another question that is asked, and that is whether you feel safe at home.
Yeah, that's a question that's asked, that's often about whether women are feeling like their environment at home is a safe environment. And it's a way of asking about family violence and whether there is a sense of safety in the home. And if you don't feel safe at home, that's an indicator that you need some support as well. So it's asked as a way of checking whether there are people in the home that are not helping the woman to feel safe.
For me, early days, I've also nearly got a 21-year-old. So early days for me, when those questions were being asked, and maybe, you know, I didn't have those thoughts, but I definitely had baby blues. I know how that feels. And for years, I've always worked on my good mental health. I think that is a really good practice for me, just like my tools that I use for my physical health, I've got tools that I use for my good mental health. What I felt 21 years ago that I don't feel now is, I would say, shame around any mental health blip or hiccup I might have had. Do you think that is one reason why people don't seek help?
I think that's a really good question to ask, because help seeking is the thing that that can really help people through really tough times. And that doesn't necessarily mean seeking professional help, it's seeking help from others. And one of the things that maybe is improving, and I hope is improving, not universally, but I'm optimistic about that.
says the psychologist.
Says the psychologist, yeah. Exactly. That the idea of not feeling quite right isn't something that makes you a bad person. And that overwhelming sense of shame, I'm failing, I'm not good enough, is because we desperately want to be a good mum. We desperately want to be the partner in the family that is, contributing positively. And I think we've got the added pressure too of, you know, a bit further down the track of going back to work and managing it all. And so this sense of shame that I'm struggling here, this feels really hard for me, makes it difficult to ask for help. And you know, that's a really tricky bind, because not asking for help means that you feel that way for longer. And it can be really hard to get yourself out of that. And so I think as family members and as partners and as other people around pregnant person or a new mum, it's part of our job to check in and to see how you're travelling, you know, and to listen and really, really listen. So sometimes I think that shame gets perpetuated because you say, how are you doing? And the mum says, well, oh, you know, it's a bit tough and, you know, God, I could do with some sleep, or they sort of minimise it and we go, oh, you'll be right, you know, you'll be fine. Oh, gosh, you know, God, this is the easy bit. Wait till they start crawling around.
Oh, my God. Honestly, there are so many, aren't there?
There are so many
unhelpful things that people say to new mums or pregnant people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, just sleep when the baby sleeps, you know. And some of those things are really well-intentioned and occasionally they're helpful. And occasionally that's a good idea to sleep when the baby sleeps, but sometimes it's not what you need to do or it's up to you. And I don't think we do enough of that. We don't say, you know, this is tough.
Mm.
We don't say, what do you think would be helpful?
Yeah.
And we often as a, you know, just as people trying to help other people, we don't seek permission before we launch into telling people what we think.
Mm.
And so, you know, Just hold back your advice giving a little bit if you're trying to support somebody who's going through becoming a new mum. It doesn't mean that you don't offer advice. It just means listen first.
One of the, I don't know, I've got a few memories that I've been trying to let go, but perhaps I haven't yet. But I remember my current mother-in-law coming in, and every time she'd see me, God love her, but every time she would see me, she would say, oh, you look so tired. And honestly, every time in my brain, I was swearing my head off at it. Like, you know, I was just like, what? Of course I'm tired. You know, this was with our third and fourth baby, and like, you know, Rex and Sully are only 13 months apart. So, yeah, of course I was tired. But that meant a lot to me. That meant I'm not coping. That meant that I wasn't able to manage four children. That meant so much to me when she said that. And there was nothing to back that up. No, let me take the older boys to the park, or there was no, how about I do the dishes? It was, can I have a cup of tea?
Yeah. And that, you know, so that's kind of the not checking in.
Mm.
Like if you're noticing someone looks tired, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, how is everything? How are you going?
Yeah.
Before you tell someone they look tired.
Mm.
Because, yeah, your answer to you look tired, that will be because I am.
I am actually tired, yeah.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting that we associate that sort of sense of looking tired with, oh, that must mean I'm not doing a good job, whereas you look tired and you're doing an amazing job.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That was part of my, you know, how I took that comment on board. Like now at a much different place where I'm getting 8 hours sleep mostly a night, like, you know, I can look at that differently now. But back then I saw it as a comment on my ability, which is, I think not, I'm not alone in that.
You're absolutely not alone in that.
Mm.
And we are so sensitive to the negative feedback. And isn't it interesting that those are the things that stand out?
Mm.
So,
yeah, I'm sure she said 100 good things to me, but why do I remember that?
So I would take a really sort of a running leap and imagine that you were somebody who was, you know, really high functioning, managing a whole lot of things in your life really competently, and then you throw in baby number three and baby number four quickly and it does stretch you. So you do have those questions of yourself, like, oh, gosh, you know, have I got all this under control? And so if you're primed to that, then any comment somebody says that makes you question a little bit more, that can feel like it really brings you down.
Mm.
So I think that's the real idea, that if we can get people to ask first rather than tell people what they look like, ask first and listen.
Mm.
It makes such a big difference.
Can you just go over what are good questions to ask? Ooh. Like, you know, if we're talking about people, like, we're well-meaning, but perhaps our foot is in our mouth and we've said things like, oh, you know, you should be happy. Isn't this what you wanted?
Yeah, yeah.
Or when I was a mum, I was able to do that on my ear type of thing. No one ever says that. But, you know, it's the implication. But
they do say that.
They do say that, yeah.
Yeah, they do. And because, you know, I hear people say, oh, well, that, you know, that's not an issue. That's an easy thing.
Yeah.
So it's recognising not everybody has the same challenges. Breastfeeding is a really, really key indicator of that, or not indicator. Like it's something that people talk about. So, you know, breastfeeding's not working, therefore I'm failing as a mum. Like that's a really, really impactful feeling for a lot of mums. That there's this sense of, you know, I want to do the absolute best for my baby, and how do I do that? And you get a whole lot of people telling you how you should be able to do that. Oh, you know, I was lucky that worked really well for me. Well, you know, that's
shut up.
That's great. And so, look, I think as people who've been mums, people who've had kids, to recognise that everybody else's experience is not the same as yours, and your solution for something may not be the right solution for that person. And so you asked me about what are good questions.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is helpful, but I think it's worth asking ourselves some questions. And I can talk about maybe what questions helpers might want to ask. But I'm wondering about suggesting to women who are pregnant or women who have had babies, what are some of the things you can ask yourself? Checking in with yourself about what's important to you, what are the things that you are doing and that you can do, and also just recognising that you're doing your best. And so some questions that come to mind are, you know, well, while you're pregnant and you're sort of starting to worry about what kind of mum am I going to be, to ask yourself, what are the things that you think are really important as a parent? What kind of parent do you want to be? What ways do you want a parent that you think really align with what's important to you and what you want for your kids to experience? And when I ask that of people that I see, it's really interesting that, and I don't use the word in the question, I say to them, what are the things that are really, really important to you as a parent? What do you want a parent like? And they say things like, I just want to be that mum who's just really present for their kids. Okay, so well, what kinds of things can you do that will help you to be that kind of parent? Like they know what kind of parent they want to be. Okay, so you've got an approach to parenting that you know is really important to you. And then everybody else's opinion starts to be a little bit less loud and a little bit less irritating or judgy. Because what do I know that's really true for how I want to parent and what's important in how I want to parent? If you can answer that, then you can just keep checking in with yourself. You know, no, these are the things I'm doing because this is the kind of parent I want to be.
So you're laying the foundation. I love that. I think sort of when you're in the process, sometimes you're just on that treadmill and you're not really spending that time and to stop and think about what it is that you, how you want to parent. But if you take that approach to anything else that you do in your life, I bet you've done a strategy, or I bet you've thought about like what you want for your career. I bet you've thought about what that particular project at work looked like or whatever. Like, yep. I don't know how many people would sort of stop and spend time and journal or have a talk with their partner about, you know, how does this work for us as a couple or as a single person if they're a single mum. I wish I had have done that.
Yeah, look, it probably would have been good for me too, but it's time and time again that, you know, women have such a wide range of reasons for why parenting is so important to them and why they're choosing to have a baby now. And so really, really knowing that you know, you're the person that gets to decide how you do those things. And I think, I don't know, I wouldn't like to, for us not to talk today about the one thing that every time I'm working with somebody who's pregnant or a new mum, it's this idea of what do you do with all that advice, which we've talked a little bit about. If there are support people around or mums of women who are having children and you hear this, maybe it'll give you a bit of an indicator to just back off a little bit.
Yeah.
But women do feel bombarded by the advice that comes at them from, I think a lot of the time from other women as well, like other mums, you know, telling you what to do. And sometimes that information's out of date as well.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. And so I've often talked to women about what you do with that because they feel like, you know, not doing those things is a problem. I say thank you.
Yeah.
So by saying thank you for what somebody offers, you honour the fact that it probably is well-intentioned and that people are offering you something because they want to feel helpful. But if it feels like you're being bombarded by it and you need a bit of distance from it, you don't have to take up everybody's advice, but you can just say, oh, thanks for that. Thanks for that. That's something I hadn't thought about.
What about if somebody's done the right thing and they've said, look, what I've got a particular action that I used that helped me. Would you like to hear it? And that new mum or that pregnant person has in their mind gone, absolutely no way. or what's a good way to politely say thank you but no?
Yeah, it's tricky because people can get very much on their soapbox about the thing that worked for them because it made such a difference for them. Maybe there's a way of just asserting that this is something that you're working on, and you could also suggest that you'll come back to them, reflect back that they're trying to offer something that's helpful, and then just state that I'm working on this and I'm working on it with my, you know, maternal child health nurse or with my partner. We're trying something out and we'll come back to you if we think we need some additional help. That would be how I would play with that.
I love asking a psychologist about boundaries because psychologists have got the best boundaries.
Yeah, you know, when I was pregnant, and everybody wants to touch you, and I'm not a touchy person. Like, that's not family and people I've given permission to, as you say. It's a very different thing. But people in the supermarket coming up to me and wanting to put their hands on me and saying, "Oh, can I touch you?" And again, I would say, thank you so much for asking. I really prefer it if people don't touch me.
Yeah.
That is just very invasive. And it's like as soon as you're pregnant, you know.
You become other's property
It's fair game apparently. And look, there's an excitement and people are positive about you being pregnant, but it is okay to say, I really prefer it if people don't touch me.
I'm going to offer a alternate view. I love people touching my belly. I loved it. I really did.
Well, then when people say to you, can I touch your belly, you go, let's do it.
So
that's all about permission.
Yeah.
All about permission.
I think what we've sort of been hinting about are people's, well, we haven't been hinting, we're talking about people's values, but also the familial sort of values as well that you've taken into your pregnancy. Can you see, and at our clinic, you see people going into pregnancy, so people just trying to get pregnant, and they come to see you. What are some of the things that they talk to you about?
There can be a range of reasons for that. So in this clinic and in my work at the hospital previously, I've had the experience of working with people in the lead up to being pregnant. I think something that's probably really important to raise is that women who've experienced sexual assault or sexual abuse will often want to talk about what being pregnant would mean for them and their concerns about being pregnant and the processes involved in being pregnant, like, you know, the medical processes in addition to their fears about bringing a child into the world who may be vulnerable to the same experiences that they had, and talking through how they can parent in a way that means that they keep their children as safe as they possibly can. That's something that I've definitely worked with people about.
And do you talk to people that perhaps if they did suffer sexual abuse by a male perpetrator or a female perpetrator, do they have an issue with whether they're going to have a male or female child?
Sometimes. Sometimes they do. And sometimes, like, it could go either way, depending on their experience. So, yeah, that's a really interesting question that sometimes people are really worried about having a girl child because they perceive that girls are more vulnerable in the world because they've, as a young girl, they've had that experience. And sometimes they are worried about bringing a male into the world if a male has been a perpetrator, and how do you raise that child? Mm. And the other issue that people come to me about is where they're worried about the kind of parent that they will be, because they feel like their own example of being parented was such a negative experience for them, that their parents weren't the kind of parents that they want to be, but they're not quite sure that how they do that.
Mm.
I don't want to perpetuate something that, because I haven't had a good model of parenting, that my child would then experience.
I want to raise another emotion, and you and I have talked about this previously, and that is that emotion of resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And that resentment might be about, you know, change in your career, or, you know, your career's changed
mm-hmm.
to a different trajectory, or resentment that your partner won't pick up his socks, or, you know, resentment that you feel like you've been pushed out of life as such,
yeah.
or your sphere of influence has shrunk. Do people come and see you about that?
I think it's unusual for people to recognise that that's what they're coming to talk about, but it's so very much features in the conversations that when you become a parent, your role changes. And if you're somebody who has worked in a place where you get to decide how things work and you've got control over things, suddenly you are at home and you don't have control feel like you've got a lot of control over what this little person is doing. And that can lead to a sense of resentment as well, you know, that I don't feel like I have that same control over the way the world works. And it's a sense of competency. It feels like I'm not as competent because I don't have everything under control. Everybody focuses on what you gained and not what you've given up. And I don't know that that's changed much in the last 20 years, this sense of, well, actually, there were lots of great things potentially about your life beforehand, and now you're doing a whole range of things that maybe get taken for granted a lot. And this sense of, as you said, you know, you responded really strongly to that idea of being told you look tired, this sense of your house not being tidy, for example, and that being a reflection of not doing a good job. I think that there's a competency overlay with that resentment that, you know, I'm not feeling like I've got everything I'm on top of everything.
One of the things that I did resent, and people who have been listening to us for a while know that I've had my first marriage and then my second marriage with Dr. Pat. So my first marriage, there was a lot of resentment about things like knowing that my ex-partner went and was able to have a coffee with his mates
mm-hmm.
During his work day. And if you've taken your baby on a coffee date yet, you know that you never finish a sentence, and it's not,
yep.
I find them really stressful. And I used to think, but I never even have the chance to go and decide mm-hmm. at a particular time I'm going to go and have a coffee. And little things like that, I really built up a lot of resentment about.
Yeah.
And so
you lose control over how you spend your time.
Yeah. And when you say about competency, one of the things that I did also with my 21-year-old was I followed a really strict routine.
Mm-hmm.
And the book said that the baby must sleep between here and here and feed for this amount of time. And at the end of every day, I used to kind of rate my day. And it was a bad day if he didn't go buy the book, like
right.
literally buy the
yeah,
book.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a friend recently who's just had a baby, and I was saying, I feel like that really robbed me of the joy of my early motherhood. By the time the fourth came along, different marriage, different, you know, me being so different, me sort of allowing myself not to feel that resentment, attaching no story to it. Like, you know, if Pat leaves his socks on the floor, he's just left the socks on the floor. It's not because he doesn't love me or doesn't respect the job I do or whatever. So I've just been able to let all that go. So it's been a massive, big change for me. And I don't know, part of me wishes that for everybody, you know, that you can just find the joy in the parenting part rather than, you know, rating yourself, giving you a score out of 10. It was terrible. Terrible parent.
You were somebody who had rated how well a day had gone and you know, self-reflective about how well you were doing your job up until that point. And then that's the competency thing. It's like, you know, well, if the child hasn't done exactly what I think that they should do by the book, then I've not done a good job. I think that there's another thing that comes about with that sense of ownership of time and just that sense of being an independent person in the world, that you come as a package. When you're the mum with the baby, and that still persists, that, you know, that's your primary job, and that if you do something independent, there is still sometimes a sense that your child's being babysat by the other parent. Can you babysit this weekend? Because I want to do X. I think we're moving on that.
I hear,
you know, younger women saying, that would not be babysitting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's parenting.
Yeah.
And that's part of your job.
Mm.
Yeah. Letting your partner know that some of those behaviours that don't contribute to the overall sort of rhythm of the house, they make it feel like that's your job too.
Mm.
And so I think you can raise that as something that's important. And it's definitely something I have as a conversation relatively frequently with new mums about this, you know, it would just be so helpful if, what would help? And they can tell you.
Mm.
They can tell you what would help. You know, just putting the bins out, just doing the dishes, or just folding a load of washing, or just contributing something from the other parent and asking for that.
Mm. I definitely, that is what happens in our household, except I do that times five now. So I ask, I have learnt that it's okay to ask. And actually, sometimes that request hasn't sort of landed in a memory bank, mm-hmm. and you have to ask again.
Yeah.
But again, there's no story attached to that. Like, I feel completely fine asking Pat and the four boys to do something now, whereas before I perhaps had a layer of guilt or layer of story around the request. I just keep asking, and that's fine.
So the burden becomes more about recognizing that it's not all on you.
It doesn't help with the mother load, though.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to admit that. Like,
the mother load, that's a great term in this context.
Yeah. It's because I'm still having to think about all those questions to ask in the first place. I don't know how to get around that. I'd love some tips from you, from anyone. what can you do apart from just continuing to ask if it's not landing in someone's memory bank? You know, how do you reduce the mother load?
Yeah, because the mother load comes with the responsibility of keeping everybody's you know, schedules and everybody's needs going, and that's a lot.
It is a lot. All right, for the last little while we've just been talking about life, you know, mm-hmm. life as a mum, life as a pregnant person. When does that tip over when someone needs to seek professional help, and who do they go to first?
And I think that it tips over when the way you're feeling has persisted. And I think I've used that word a little bit, that when, you know, having a day where you feel a bit flat, but then the next day or so you feel, you know, I actually feel better now. But if that feeling of feeling very anxious or feeling very flat and very low persists, and, you know, it's been like 2 weeks and you're feeling really, really strongly like there's not a lot of positivity, or that anxiety is overwhelming you and it's getting in the way of doing the things you need to do each day, that's your indicator that this is now something that has gone for too long, and the normal things that you would do to support yourself, they're just not working. Seek some help. First professional person to talk to is our GP. They are the best person to talk to about what's happening for you now and what your options are. And for some people, maybe you need to talk to your partner first and say, this is where I'm at, because maybe it would be helpful to have that support. But really, the time to seek professional help is where it just doesn't feel like it's getting better. And I think we've also spoken about that if you're having really worrying thoughts about yourself, your safety, thoughts about suicide or thoughts about hurting the baby, that is the absolutely the time to seek immediate help. People can also ring Lifeline on 13, 11, 14 at any time. That's what those are there for. So I have people who say, oh, yeah, but, you know, I don't want to use that service if, you know, if I don't really need it. If you're thinking that maybe it would be helpful to talk to somebody, that is what that service is there for.
Mm.
So services like Lifeline and Beyond Blue, and there is a postnatal and depression line as well, and there is a parent line, and maybe we can link
those in the show notes. Now, what if it's not that person that's recognised their symptoms but their partner has, if they've got a partner? What are some ways that that partner can help?
I think the partner can help by expressing to their partner that they are concerned, to say that I've noticed, to show the observation, to say that I've noticed that you've been, you know, feeling really down. I've noticed that you've been really worried, whatever it is for them. And I'm wondering how I can help. If you're really concerned about safety, then that is something that you would raise as, I think it's time. It might be time to talk to the GP and see if we can get you some help.
After someone's seen their GP, what sort of treatment would they then expect?
So I think that's why GP is a really good person to see, because they can guide you through what the options are. And for some people, medication would be something that the GP would talk to them about as being really helpful for them. And that's something that to talk to a GP about. And if someone was referred to a psychologist, obviously I can talk a little bit more about what that would look like. And you know, we would probably just describe that generally as talk therapy. And the most common sort of talk therapy that psychologists work with is something called CBT or cognitive behaviour therapy. When you have these really strong feelings, that they are really interconnected with the thoughts that you're having and the things that you're doing. So thoughts being cognitions and the things that you're doing being behaviours. So I say to people, it's like three points of a triangle, that you have cognitions or thoughts on one point, you have behaviours or what you're doing on another, and then you have your emotions on the third point of the triangle, and we can get really trapped in that triangle. So you keep thinking things that are anxiety provoking or negative, and you keep doing things that aren't helping you to feel better, and you keep feeling not great. Mm-hmm. So you bounce around between thoughts and feelings and behaviours, and what psychologists can work with is, what are the patterns in your thinking that aren't as helpful, and what sorts of ways of thinking about things would be more helpful, and also what are some of the things that you could do that would support you to feel like your mood lifts or to feel less anxious. And we've talked about a few of those in terms of good self-care, taking some time out, having some time on your own, doing exercise, eating well, those kinds of things, and sleep behaviours. And psychologists should be able to work with somebody to help them to feel a bit brighter, their mood to feel a bit better, and to feel less anxious by working on those things together.
And how many treatment sessions would someone typically have?
I mean, it can range. Our Medicare system enables people to see a psychologist initially for 6 sessions, and then with a GP review, an additional 4. And for a lot of people, that's enough. Mm. But if people have sort of more, you know, more severe mood disturbance or have longer standing issues, then longer time can be really helpful as well.
And I know we haven't touched on it, but could you tell us about partner depression and anxiety? Is that a common thing?
Yeah, it is increasingly being recognised as a time in life where there's significant change for the non-birthing partner as well. Because of all of the things we've talked about, like role changes and trying to understand how, you know, you work in the world now. And I think that the data says that there's about 1 in 10 fathers who have been who experience changes in mood that are significant. The same applies for non-birthing parents who are women as well. That change in role can really change the way that you view the world and that you view yourself and that you view your relationship. And so, yeah, definitely encourage the non-birthing partner to recognise that their mental health can also be affected by this change in life and sometimes unexpectedly.
Now, I want to ask the three pieces of advice, but do you think we've just covered them?
We probably have.
Yeah.
But it's probably worth separating out, just you said, what do you do if you're the partner or a person who cares? And I think if I were to sum that up, I would say your first job is to listen.
Oh, yeah.
And then to show the person that you love them and that you're trying to understand them. And then if you need to link them to supports that are professional supports. So those three things, listen, show that love and understanding and link them into supports if they need them. For individuals, I think the thing to really remember is that you're not alone, that this is really a common experience of a big role transition time, a big change in life, that your mood and your level of anxiety can be affected. Postnatal depression and anxiety are really treatable, that with support and with strategies that you can improve and feel so much better. And then also just to remember to do the things that are good for all of us, that the kind of taking care of yourself stuff, like finding ways to get some time that is on your own, some time out, some support, eating good food, and doing the things that promote best sleep if you can. Like, you know, when you do sleep, do the things that do help with sleep. So, you know, having time without devices before you go to bed. When you do wake up, not turning on every light in the house if you are going to just do a check and come back. Like some of those, keeping the sleeping environment sort of low stimulation, those kinds of things can really help as well.
Yeah, and exercise and getting out of nature, and I love all of those things.
I think that I knew how important that was for me personally when I had a little baby at home, because if my partner came home and said, "So, have you been for a walk today?" I knew that maybe I didn't seem quite myself, but if he came home and he said, "Oh, so, you know, where did you go for a walk today?" It was obvious that I'd been out and about. And it was just for me, that was, as you say, there's something for you that works. For other women I know, it's making sure that at some point in the day they have a whole cup of tea or coffee while it's hot.
Yeah.
Rather than never ever finishing a hot drink. So find the thing that for you says, this is something I'm doing just for me. And
great advice.
And that can make a really big difference.
That is a great way to end our very long chat. That was great, Kylie. Thank you so much for all your knowledge and your wisdom. And I'm sure so many people get a lot out of that conversation.
Oh, I hope so, because it can be such a challenging time, but also there are moments that will just be so special for the rest of your life as well.
Well, everyone, that's us for this week. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. Bye for now.